This is the Iowa Arts Showcase, Iowa Public Radio's monthly performing arts program devoted to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to our March edition of the Iowa Arts Showcase. Three specialists help us investigate ISU's Silver Code as it undergoes a major restoration, reviving it for its many curtain calls to come. Dr. Robert Larson reflects on his efforts with Douglas Duncan to establish the nationally recognized Des Moines Metro Opera. We'll hear about the Des Moines Choral Society's world premiere of a work by Stacy Gibbs being presented at their spring concert. Iowa Public Radio's John Pemble tells us about a new CD release and an unusual subscription program called Songbook Project. And we'll explore the many cultural offerings that will be featured in Iowa City's upcoming Mission Creek Festival. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase.
I remember going in to see C.Y. Stevens as a student. I have no idea what the performance was, but I remember just being blown away by the beauty of that curtain. 40 years later, I look back and going through some of the research myself, I found attributions to a dialogue that Bill Fisher and Dr. Hilton and others had within the board, and it was because of cost as well as impact. And as you know, all of the Iowa State Center was built with private monies. It was the first such undertaking for Iowa State University, and the budget was pretty tight. And they had allocated $3,500 for a regular proscenium curtain in the budget. And Bill Fisher had been recently on business to Japan and wanted to do this magnificent curtain. And there was a dialogue about, well, Iowa State values are, we're a little humble, and this was a little ostentatious, and we weren't sure that that was the appropriate statement. And Dr. Hilton stayed true to his vision that he wanted to transport people. He wanted them to know they were coming to a special place of learning and culture. Bill Fisher, too, wanted that. And so that was when Bill Fisher said that he would pay the difference between the $3,500 of what was in the budget and the $2,000 to have it loomed and then $50,000 to have it brought to the United States. And I do believe it transports people. When you're in there, you know you're in a special place. And I remember that being in that special place. Again, I don't remember what the performance was, but I do remember that curtain, and the beauty of it just was incredible. And the aesthetics live in your heart. And I think as we have listened to people in the last few months, as we've tried to recreate this history, because a lot of this history was lost, so we really have had to recreate it. And a lot of it has been oral history. People will talk about the beauty of the curtain.
Director of Museums at Iowa State and longtime fan, Lynette Pullman, talking about the curtain gracing the C.Y. Stevens stage for nearly 45 years. Now that Lynette has successfully taken this incredible work of art under her wing, she has enlisted the aid of three dedicated ISU Musketeers. A graduate student in English, Claire Friesel, is involved with the assignment. ISU's anthropology senior, Amy Lowry, assists under the direction of ISU's textile conservation fellow and coordinator of this massive facelift, Kate Greeter. Also involved on this enormous venture is ISU's associate professor of architecture and sustainable environments, Jason Allreed. Lynette, Jason, and Kate fill us in on the background behind this major project.
I've been looking at that curtain for a long time, since 1970 when I first got here as a student. And later as I became associated with museums, I've always wanted to have it into the permanent collection. But because of best practices for museum standards, you must be able to care for any object you take into the collection. And up until recently, we didn't have that financial capacity to conserve the curtain, which has needed care for some time. With that capacity, then came this idea that we did accession it very recently into the University Museum's permanent collection, and now are undertaking the conservation. And so it is one of those wonderful transformative works of art that are at Iowa State, our first one being the central campus that we have that was developed by our first president. This is an ongoing tradition at Iowa State of a beautiful place. That's also one of the books that we're working on with Jason and others.
Jason, tell us a little bit about the history of this magnificent curtain and the building that it's in.
The building, C.Y. Stevens Auditorium, was the first piece of the Iowa State Center, which was the vision of President Hilton to create a center for cultural outreach for the university. C.Y. Stevens then is the large auditorium for that, 2,700 seats, and was intended to deal both with performances, vocal performances, stage performances, and create a large-scale venue to be able to bring very sort of large names, be able to bring people to campus from around the world and to exhibit that to Central Iowa and to the university.
And really to the world. It was quite a splash when it opened.
Yes, absolutely. The New York Philharmonic, I believe, was the opening performance. The building opened in 1969 and really has a great presence on the campus. It was one of those modernist buildings that was functionally expressive. It was beautifully assembled. It was widely hailed as one of the finest buildings in the Midwest at the time and was written about nationally and internationally as such.
And you are going to have an article placed in an upcoming architectural magazine about this curtain and about your project.
Actually, what I'm writing is the architectural components of a book that the University Museums is producing on the campus artwork, the landscape architecture, and the architecture which traces the history of Iowa State, having an aesthetic guiding principle as part of the mission of the university.
Kate, how did you get involved in this project, and how did you know what to do and where to go? And give us some more history on this curtain.
I came into this because I was getting a degree in textile conservation here and was in a class, and I met Lynette, who mentioned this project, and it really fell on the right ears. Because in textile conservation, the opportunity to work on a tapestry so large is completely unprecedented. So I graduated and was wanting to work on this, and it was perfect timing. And did a little of the preliminary research. This is all about a year ago. And then that led us up until, I think we started officially on August 26th. The curtain is actually 80 feet by 35 feet and weighs about 3,000 pounds. It varies depending on the weather. It will take on about 100 pounds. And it was donated to Iowa State by J.W. Fisher, Bill Fisher of Marshalltown.
And this is the Fisher that has the Fisher Hall out in New York City and has given so much to the arts.
Exactly. Same person. And he saw this while at a Chiba Cultural Center in Chiba, Japan, which is right outside of Tokyo, and said, that's what I want for Iowa State, and commissioned one that's, it's not a twin, but it's definitely a noticeable predecessor to the one at Iowa State.
And who is the artist for this curtain?
That's something we've just discovered in the research, and it's a Japanese designer who actually focused on sculpture work for most of his life, but he designed it along with several others in a period of 7 years, and his name is Ryokichi Mukai. So the original one that he saw was produced in 1967 when he was in Japan, and then he said, I want one similar. So whether he actually met the designer, I don't know. I would be very curious. And in fact, I just made a trip over to Emerson in Marshalltown to look into the company archives and try to figure that out.
And tell us about then the mill in Japan and what was so unusual about this.
The mill is called Kawashima Textile Mill. They've been making all sorts of different textiles, including stage curtains, for over 100 years, and in fact still are. And in fact, they have a loom that's actually double the size of the one that made this particular curtain.
And how many people actually wove this curtain?
It was 7 people, 4 months. It took them 4 months.
And then how did they get it to Iowa?
I've got it all the way until the last step. So they rolled it up in a crate. So when it weighed 3,000 pounds unto itself, it weighed over 5,600 pounds to ship. It came over from Kyoto, so it came over through the Panama Canal, then up the eastern seaboard in the St. Lawrence Seaway, down to Chicago, and then from Chicago it came over to Ames. And I have heard all different stories of how it got here from Chicago. I have seen photos of it being unloaded on a semi. However, supposedly it was also on the rail, so I'm not sure.
And it has a special name as well.
It does, and based on the original Japanese, it looks like it could be a couple different things. Silver Signal, we had a debate with Silver Signal, Silver Code, Silver, I'm trying to remember the other one, but we narrowed it down to three and eventually went with Silver Code.
And you just recently uncovered something very special about this curtain, which you didn't even know that it had.
We did just uncover a signature, and it's right there. I can't believe we missed it, but it's definitely a signature. And we contacted the loom, and in fact, he did sign several of his pieces.
Tell us about the cleaning process and how it's going.
It's coming along well. We're about 75 to 80% finished. And in fact, tomorrow we're doing the top 5 feet that we can't reach. So as we speak, it's actually being lowered, which is it's never done since 1969. Otherwise, most of the work is done on an elevated lift, and I just go up and down on days when there obviously is not a show in the auditorium.
And how do you do this?
Well, none of it's particularly fancy, but we have a conservation vacuum, paintbrushes, and then we're using just microfiber rags to go in and get the layers of dust that have accumulated over the years.
So, Lynette, when you come in and look at this, are you saying, wow, I can really tell where they've been? Or
absolutely. Absolutely. Wow, you can tell where they've been. Think about if you hadn't dusted your living room for 47 years. This is what the curtain is about, and you can certainly see where they've gone. It now glistens and sheen and shine, and if there's a little bit of air movement, especially the silver tassels, really glisten. And it's very dirty where they haven't cleaned. It's really pretty amazing to step back and look at this.
Lynette adds that once the curtain is returned to its original splendor, that she will design a regular maintenance plan to keep the curtain in tip-top shape. Lynette, Kate, and Jason continue.
You know, I'd have to say that the curtain is just a wonderful counterpoint to that building. Buildings in the late 60s, modernist buildings, had a tendency to be fairly severe, and this building might fall under the category of what would have been considered a brutalist building in many ways. It's a concrete exposed building. It's cedar wood. It has a tendency to have a very minimized material palette, and so that curtain, as materially rich and colorful as it is, really brings the theater to life, and it wouldn't be the same building without it, and that's really significant to note, the interplay between the artistic quality of that and the intent of the building is really a perfect counterpoints to one another.
Iowa State is known as a very practical institution, but we are known as a very beautiful place as well, and part of the books that Jason is working on, it really is about the beautiful campus, and it was a core practical value in 1858 to make a beautiful campus. And it is important to think of beauty and aesthetics as integral to your learning and your educational experience. Everyone learns better when you see beauty and are inspired. And that curtain is a contemporary reflection of that 19th century value. So for us, it's a continuum. It's not just a pop-up accident that happened in the 1960s. It's a continuum of what we hold dear at Iowa State.
Tell us about what would be involved if you had to replace this curtain. What would that value be?
I contacted the loom, and they said that it would cost around 60 million yen, which translated to $592,000. And so it was originally loomed for $20,500 back in 1969.
And Lynette, what do you feel about the replacement value with this curtain?
It's irreplaceable. It is a symbol of Iowa State University. It is a landmark, iconic image of the university, and especially at that moment in time when the Iowa State Center and C.Y. Stevens Auditorium were the symbol of the university being modern, being contemporary, and fulfilling its larger mission. You just can't replace those sorts of things, and that's why you conserve them. If you could, you'd go buy a regular old curtain and hang it out there. It's not the same. I do think it's wonderful when there are events in C.Y. Stevens now and those performances that allow it, they still see the curtain and people comment on it, and it really is creating quite a wonderful buzz to the audiences that are coming to C.Y. Stevens, and they in turn, many people are contacting Kate and telling their stories, and that's been I don't know if that's a singular celebration, but it is a celebration.
I think that's been one of my favorite parts about the project is that just last week we had an open house, and I couldn't believe how many people came out to see it, actually. And then also just last week, I had a group of people that were there on opening night that came to reminisce about that week, in fact. And that started an organization in Ames where a new orchestra was coming every year, and they would stay in the homes of Ames residents, and they loved coming to Ames. And hearing these stories has been one of the highlights of this project.
I have a trivia question for you. What was the first performance on the stage of C.Y. Stevens Auditorium? Do you know?
I don't know if that was the first performance, but I thought the New York Philharmonic played.
3 days before the New York Philharmonic played, the Cowsills were the opening performance, and the first performer to step on stage was Kenny Rogers of the First Edition. And that came out in one of our open houses. And then we were able to go back and make sure that that was accurate and true. And indeed it was. And it was a time for them to kind of shake out to see if the auditorium would work. The ushers knew where to go and the curtain would go up. And they even commented that they thought everything went well that night with the Cowsills, except there was a 10-second delay on the curtain. They wondered whether it would go up or down at that particular time. And it did. It worked just fine. But I think we've forgotten that it was actually a rock band who opened C.Y. Stevens Auditorium, which I think in hindsight is quite wonderful to go from a rock band to the Philharmonic Orchestra.
Lynette Pullman, Director of Museums at Iowa State, ISU's Associate Professor of Architecture and Sustainable Environments, Jason Allreed, and ISU's Textile Conservation Fellow and Project Coordinator, Kate Greeter. Private financial donations to aid in the current large conservation and maintenance of the Silver Code will gratefully be accepted by ISU's University Museums or the ISU Foundation. For more details on the Silver Code, please go to their website at museums.iastate.edu. The Silver Code project will also be featured in the April edition of the Iowa Architect magazine. Don't go away. Dr. Robert Larson shares the inside scoop on the Des Moines Metro Opera. Find out about an upcoming world premiere being performed by the Des Moines Choral Society. Hear John Pemble's investigation into a unique program called the Songbook Project. And discover the cultural offerings being presented at Iowa City's upcoming Mission Creek Festival. That's all ahead. You're listening to the Iowa Arts Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
Well, my feelings are amazement. When it began, it was the moment that counted, not the future. But if anybody had asked me where it was going to go, I would say it was going to go straight up. But I guess I didn't know that it would ascend to quite the stature that it has. Then it's a matter of maintaining that stature for the future and building on it. And therein is the great challenge. But I know that the company is up to that.
Dr. Robert Larson, the Des Moines Metro Opera's founder and artistic director emeritus, and also professor emeritus of music from Simpson College. Have you ever wondered how a nationally recognized opera company ended up in Iowa? It all started when an 8-year-old young man from Walnut became hooked on opera. Dr. Larson set the stage when he received his Bachelor of Music from Simpson, his Master's from the University of Michigan, and his Doctorate from Indiana University. He initiated the groundwork for his original opera vision in the 60s.
My first venture was the Des Moines Civic Opera Company in 1964 and 1965. I should mention that I really had quite a sophisticated program at Simpson, and it produced some wonderful singers. One of those singers was Carol Stewart, who was a fantastic soprano who had actually graduated with me but remained in the area, and she became sort of prima donna assoluta in those early productions and with the beginnings of the Des Moines Metro Opera as well. And then Robert Goodloe, who would come to Simpson as a public relations man and wanted to sing. He didn't read music, but I worked with him on a variety of repertory and audition material, and he managed to win the Des Moines Metropolitan Auditions in 1964, and then the next year went on to win the National Met Auditions on the stage of the Metropolitan Opera. And Bob was a part of the Des Moines Civic Venture, too. Carol and Bob were stars in La Traviata that we produced at Hoyt Sherman in 1964. And then in 1965, Bob returned from the Met to do Marcello in La Boheme, and Carol again was Mimi. That was a very successful venture. We had a board and a budget, but I also knew that it probably couldn't continue in the same format. We lost $500 on the Boheme, and that didn't encourage the board very much. So I knew that I'd have to go on to something else, and I waited a while before I did that. I worked on the doctorate at Indiana and then came back to begin the regional opera concept, and that happened in the late 60s and the beginning of the 70s.
And Simpson plays an important part in this. While it's not part of the company itself, it really has become sort of a home for you to host this Des Moines Metro Opera.
It's absolutely true. The opera company could not have existed without Simpson. I mean, in a very real way, because the students formed a major part of it in the beginning. Students built sets for the first seasons, and they acted as choristers and compromario singers. So it was very much of a Simpson-based thing. And besides that, there was the theater. We couldn't do an opera festival until there was the theater where we could perform opera with an orchestra in the pit. And that came about because Simpson was designing a theater, and I was on the committee for the design. So we worked with architect Chick Herbert to produce plans for a theater that we looked at Webster College in St. Louis and the Guthrie Theater. And we also looked at the Vivian Beaumont Theater at Lincoln Center. Arena-style theaters with something of an extended stage. Chick developed for us an arena-style theater with a proscenium stage and a four stage separated by the orchestra pit, and it was quite a mind-blowing design. But this theater became a home to the opera company because there was no other place, and still is no other place, to perform opera in Des Moines.
Tell us how, then, you decided to get it started and how it happened.
Late in the 60s, I had a cohort in crime, Douglas Duncan, who was a student at Simpson, a tenor, very fine tenor, and also interested in all phases of opera production. And we talked endlessly about trying to develop an opera company. Then he left for graduate school at Philadelphia Musical Academy in a special program in opera in 1972. And that was just about the time I thought it was appropriate to begin the opera company. So we spoke almost every night on the telephone and making special plans for the company and how things could be done, because we had every intention of beginning in the summer of 1973. And so when he came home for the holidays, we visited a friend of ours, Dr. Lawrence Eli, who was a physician and surgeon in Des Moines and whose son, Stephen Eli, had been our lighting designer at Simpson, and he was very excited about our plans and said that he would form a board, and he did, and it was a very high-powered board. He was the president, and Don Easter of the Easter Stores was the vice president, and they worked very hard, and then we had to begin the fundraising business, which was daunting to say the least. Our first fundraising call was to Hy-Vee, because we'd heard that Dwight Vredenburg was very much interested in music. He was the CEO of Hy-Vee, or the manager, or something of that nature, in Sheraton. Well, that call yielded absolutely nothing, and we knew we had to go elsewhere. We had friends in Clear Lake, John and Doris Salisbury, and we thought we'd talk to them about the proposition. John was the CEO of the Salisbury Laboratories in Charles City, which manufactured poultry medications, and the Madrigal Singers had done a concert in their recital hall. And Mrs. Salisbury, Doris, was tremendously impressed by the group and by the college. So it would just seem rather logical to talk to them about our dreams about an opera company. And so we did, and we made a presentation on that spring afternoon. And John said it sounded pretty crazy to him and picked up his evening paper and went to the porch, but he told Doris she could do what she wanted to do. And Doris said it sounded wild to her, too, but she would give us a chance if we really wanted it and would give us $5,000. Well, $5,000 doesn't sound very much now, but in that time it sounded like we just hung the moon. And so we drove back on 2-lane highway through Dowse, Iowa, with an elevator on one side of the road and a bar tavern on the other side. And we went into the tavern and bought a round of beers for the farmers there so they could toast the new Des Moines Opera Company. Those guys didn't have any idea what we were blabbering about, but they certainly enjoyed the beers. And we went back to Des Moines and we began the real difficult task of bringing a $22,000 budget into focus. It was a daunting task, and that first season was kind of a miracle because it all happened so quickly.
And then did you have a summer season then?
Yes, we had a summer season in 1973. I planned it very carefully so that we would have the possibility of sets for the shows based on things we had done at Simpson, and that we would have singers that were available for the appropriate operas. And besides that, I wanted to bring in critics from outside so we could be accepted as a full-fledged opera company. And so we chose La Rondine by Puccini, The Swallow, which was almost never done in those days, and a double bill of Prima Donna by Arthur Benjamin, a North American professional premiere of that work, and a double bill with Menotti's The Medium. And then also Benjamin Britten's Albert Herring, a comedy that was scarcely 20 years old. Very unusual repertory, but it did the trick. And we were able to bring critics from Minneapolis and Kansas City papers and Opera News and Musical America. And they all gave us very positive, laudatory reviews. And as a matter of fact, I remember the Opera News review talked about, referring to Rondine, Swallow, the fledgling opera company that soared to unbelievable heights. And that was the beginning of things, really. And we never received then or since a negative review. So we're thrilled about that.
Let's talk a little bit about you and your role in this, because you have this background in piano. And then also, how does that influence your work? But also, you were the conductor plus the stage director, which is quite rare as well. Tell us how this all helped build the Des Moines Metro Opera.
Being a pianist helped a great deal because I always could embody everything at the keyboard. I dreamed a complete opera from having played through at the keyboard, and of course I could coach singers. That's a great advantage. And then realizing an orchestra score at the keyboard was also very important for me in preparing operas. So I always say that the piano is the center of my universe, has been from earliest years. And as far as combining stage direction and musical direction, I did that almost from the very beginning. Well, actually, from the very beginning. When I was a sophomore in college, Mu Phi Epsilon, the professional music sorority, wanted to put on a Mahl and the Night Visitors at Christmas time, and they selected me to do the direction. Well, I think they were selecting me to do the stage direction, but I didn't quite get the idea, so I did it all, musical and stage direction, and that's been the combination ever since. It's always seemed tremendously natural to me. That's unheard of anymore. It used to be done. In the 19th century, there were conductors that also did stage direction, but I think that was in days when stage direction was less elaborate than it is now. But in this situation, we didn't have a situation where the stage director and the musical director disagreed. They were always of one mind. And then I could have musical rehearsals where I could do some dramatic things and staging rehearsals where I could have musical rehearsals right alongside of it. So it seemed very natural. I'm sure some singers came to us that were completely surprised by my doing it all, but nobody ever really complained. Nobody ever complained. So I've always believed that it worked very well, at least for me. When I think back on it, I'm a little amazed that it all happened as well as it did and seemed so natural, but it did.
Dr. Robert Larson, the Des Moines Metro Opera's founder and artistic director emeritus. If you would like to hear Dr. Larson's entire interview, please go to our website at iowapublicradio.org and click on Classical Iowa at the top of the page. Next month, Iowa Public Radio's Performance Iowa will present their Arias in April series, which will open with the Des Moines Metro Opera's Romeo and Juliet production from last summer. On April 6th, the Opera Iowa Singers will perform their Arias in Ames concert. For more details about this special program and the Des Moines Metro Opera's 2014 festival season, please see their website at desmoinesmetroopera.org. Tonight at 7:30 and tomorrow afternoon at 2, Ballet Des Moines and the Des Moines Community Orchestra will present Cinderella at the Civic Center of Greater Des Moines. Tickets are available through Ticketmaster and at the door. Students from Grinnell College's Chamber Ensembles will be heading over spring break to Prague for study, master classes, and performances. UNI's Northern Iowa Symphony will also head to Brazil to perform with the Caxias do Sul University Orchestra. Former Iowa Public Radio and television host Peter Hamlin will return to our state to present a free concert called Electronic Music Mayhem on March 25th at 7:30 p.m. at UNI's Great Hall of the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center. Just ahead, we'll learn about the Des Moines Choral Society's special friendship with a composer and their performance of a world premiere of one of his works. We'll hear details about a new CD release, and we'll explore highlights from this spring's Mission Creek Festival. You're listening to the Iowa Arts Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. It's the Iowa Art Showcase. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum.
I'm Karen Impala. Each week at this time, we feature concerts and recitals recorded
throughout the cultural
Iowa.
Richness of our state to your radio. Iowa Public Radio Classical.
You know, I've often said, as many of my colleagues have, wouldn't it be nice if everybody sang in a choir? There's, you know, where people come together and they have their skills, they have their emotions, they have their intellects about music, and they're willing to put all those things together in one direction and one sense of purpose. And so that giving and sharing of those aspects of one's abilities, I think, is really just philosophically a beautiful thing to do. So socially, you know, just to see that kind of activity and enlivening the arts, which is, you know, what, as you look back over history, what's remembered about various times, various locations, and it's in part, certainly, the culture that's there. So we like being able to, in rehearsals, you know, be able to touch the past or touch genius if we're to be singing Bach or Mozart or Brahms or any of these great composers. But we also have that means of being something bigger than we would be on our own. And it's empowering, it's beautiful.
Iowa State's Professor of Music and Director of Choral Activities, Dr. James Rohde, talking about one of the most rewarding joys of life, making music. This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. The Des Moines Choral Society, whose motto is Something to Sing About, will be presenting their spring concert with the Ames Chamber Artists on April 5th under their director, Dr. Rohde. The opening half of the concert will include works by Clausen, Stanford, Paulus, Tekele, Averett, Brahms, and Stacy Gibbs. After discovering Stacy Gibbs's music, Dr. Rohde says their friendship started with a phone call.
Stacy, of the quite a number of pieces that he's actually just really starting to put out now, two of them we've selected for our performance. One is a setting of All My Trials, but the second one is the one we're kind of excited about, is because when he came and visited us about right at the end of January, but he'd written a setting of My Soul's Been Anchored in the Lord, and many people probably know of that melody, and I suppose many of the listeners have heard Moses Hogan's arrangement of that. But Stacy wrote it, and wrote it specifically for us. And so he had the first listen of it when he came, and we'll be giving the premiere performance of that in April. He's becoming more and more popular around the country as a foremost arranger of spirituals. He will get an idea at some point. When he gets it, he wants to immediately get to his computer and start typing it in. And it might be just in addition to this melody he's got in his mind, a new rhythmic take on it, or maybe some little twists and turns that are going to make it his. And he gets right to it, because he's in my talking with me, he said, if I don't, I can lose it and forget about it. So when it hits him, he wants to get on it right away. He lives in the Detroit area, and he was here visiting us at Iowa State University right at the end of January. And so in addition to being with the Des Moines Choral Society, he was up on campus, and we had three of our groups here singing his music. All told, we had seven Stacy Gibbs pieces being sung that weekend. He was in the midst of it, and it didn't take long for the students and the members of the Des Moines Choral Society to feel, you know, a real kinship with him.
So how did you discover his music, Dr. Rohde?
Well, I guess it goes back a few years ago when I was looking at the spiritual of his that I was doing with the choir. And I called him and said, you know, the marking that you've got here, as far as the tempo goes, I'm struggling with it. I'd like to do it at a different tempo. And that's when we kind of had a few chuckles on the phone. He just said, go for it. That sounds great. Make music. He's the kind of person that once he hands you the score, he loves to sit back, and he'll have some ideas that, you know, stylistically that he would like to contribute, but he also is eager to see what you might do with it. So one thing kind of led to the next as far as getting him on campus. He actually contacted my wife after her choir sang at the National ACDA Convention in Dallas this past March, and said, I'd love to share some music with you. So they started getting a little bit of a musical relationship over the phone and over the internet, and he wrote a couple pieces for our women's choir, which they are performing now and are very successful. Kind of one thing led to the next, so I called him and invited him in, see if he'd have an interest in coming into campus. He did, and he wrote a piece as well for my men's choir, which they premiered that this past fall, a setting called Every Time I Feel the Spirit. It's been fun developing this relationship with Stacy.
Dr. James Rohde, professor of music and director of choral activities at Iowa State and music director of the Des Moines Choral Society. The DMCS will present their spring concert, premiering Stacy Gibbs's My Soul's Been Anchored in the Lord, and also sing his setting of All My Trials on April 5th at 7:30 p.m. at St. Ambrose Cathedral in Des Moines. The concert concludes with Fauré's Requiem. To learn more details about their spring program and how to get tickets, please go to dmchoral.org. Just ahead, IPR's John Pemble speaks with Max Wellman about a unique jazz project, and we'll hear about the headliners for this year's Mission Creek Festival in Iowa City. You're listening to the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
Oh.
Welcome to Iowa Public Radio's Performance Iowa broadcast.
Hi, I'm Kurt Snook on the choral tradition. Today,
welcome to University Concert. I'm Karen Impala.
Bringing the cultural richness of our state to your radio, Iowa Public Radio Classical.
Welcome back. This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. Most albums are a group of songs acquired as a single body of music on a vinyl record, CD, or download. But some musicians are challenging this decades-old system. Iowa Public Radio's arts and culture reporter, John Pemble, visits a young jazz performer who is exploring a new distribution and sales model that delivers music every month to subscribers.
I, who was lost and lonely, believing life was only a bitter, tragic joke, have found with you the meaning of existence, oh my love. You must believe in love and trust it's on its way.
22-year-old Max Wellman began working as a full-time musician 3 years ago after dropping out of music school. During that time, he's been busy performing shows and recording in Des Moines, including his new CD, You Must Believe in Spring.
I'm not a jazz vocalist like Ella Fitzgerald or Sarah Vaughan. I sing these songs very much like art songs. And there's an element of improvisation and jazz technique. But I would say I still come at it very much from a classical perspective.
All of the songs on this album are by composers like Cole Porter, Frank Sinatra, and George Gershwin. Wellman says they are arranged with strings to combine his love of classical music with jazz.
As you get into the jazz world, there's a huge emphasis on tradition at first, but then, okay, what are you doing to make this your own? You know, what is your cross to bear in this genre? At least that's how it seems to me. And I more and more am getting comfortable with, I don't know, trying to champion these beautiful melodies as a singer. And I think they should be respected very much in the same way that the work of those classical composers is.
This is Wellman's third body of work released as a traditional music collection, but that's only a small portion of what he's publishing. For 2 years, he's also been releasing a handful of recordings every month called the Songbook Project. It is a music subscription program where every month subscribers are sent an email with instructions on how to download new recordings. Subscribers pay $7.50 a month, or for an extra fee, the music is sent to them on a CD. Wellman began his third year of the Songbook Project with music from his live concerts, like this November show in downtown Des Moines.
Is you is or is you ain't my baby? The way you're acting lately makes me doubt.
Wellman says some people are confused when he talks about having a new album in addition to new songs he releases every month.
It's been hard to describe the project to people, which is silly, really, because it's, you know, it's just a music subscription. It's not the typical studio-produced album that you'll get, but it's high-quality music, maybe with a little bit of a rough edge to it, that you get each month.
I'll forget you, I will, while yet you are still living inside my brain.
Because the music is from live shows, the cost of production is cheaper compared with a studio album. Even though it is more profitable, Wellman isn't sure if he'll use this model beyond 2014.
In order to make it sustainable, we need some more subscribers. I see it being something that we can continue indefinitely, and I'd like to. It just makes sense to do. I wouldn't be surprised if several years from now, there's more and more people doing the subscription model.
Between now and December, Wellman will send out 50 songs for the Songbook Project. He hasn't recorded all of them yet, but says he should be finished by May.
Oh, isn't it romance?
Thanks to IPR's John Pemble. Just ahead, we'll be scouting out the hundreds of cultural offerings being presented as part of this year's Mission Creek Festival. You're listening to the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
My name is Andre Perry. I work at the Englert Theater in downtown Iowa City, as well as with Mission Creek Festival. I am inspired by amazing artistic experiences, whether they are local, national, or international, and I love community work. I love and am inspired by Iowa Public Radio because it so often enables those experiences that I talk about, whether it's getting the word out there to us across the state or supporting artists and bringing more light to the great cultural things that happen in the state of Iowa.
If you appreciate and value the cultural programming on Iowa Public Radio, like the Englert Theater's executive director and Mission Creek Festival co-founder and director Andre Perry does, please make your tax-deductible IPR contribution at iowapublicradio.org. This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. This year's Mission Creek Festival is scheduled for April 1st through the 6th in downtown Iowa City.
Mission Creek Festival is basically a week-long festival, and it programs a ton of different mediums of art forms. The cores of the festival have always been music and literature, but over the years it's expanded to include food culture. This year it includes film. There's also some visual art that occurs during the festival. There's some kind of borderline theater elements that happen. And there's even kind of a cross stitch between creativity and tech world that's going to happen this year. So it's in some ways all over the place, but we're always like looking at these different mediums, seeing the connections, and then appreciating the programs, you know, as they are sometimes just within their own mediums. And so this might look like a concert happening. It might look like a writer giving a reading, or it might look like, you know, having a writer and a musician in the same room talking about their different crafts and how they approach them.
Tell us about some of the things that are coming, and you do have some very big names that will be at the festival this year.
Yeah, this year headliners includes Philip Glass, the legendary composer, is coming through, as well as the author Rachel Kushner, whose book The Flamethrowers last year was nominated for the National Book Award, and also some other musicians, including Jason Isbell, who's a singer-songwriter out of the South, who was, you know, famously in the Drive-By Truckers for a long time and then struck off on his solo career and just had a really breakthrough album last year. They got a lot of notice on both coasts and all over the country. And so those are kind of like the core attendees of the festival are going to come out. But then in addition to that, you know, there's over 100 of musicians and writers and other artists who are going to be taking part in the festival, as well as a lot of folks from Iowa.
Now, this year's literary program, you're actually going to have a writer in residence who just happens to be an Ames native. Tell us about him.
Yeah, Brian Evanson. He lives in Rhode Island now, but he's coming back to, I guess, to his home state to join us. He's another great writer. He's written a lot. Yeah, I think he has about 13, 14 books at this point. He's written mystery novels. He's written some controversial stuff about his Mormon upbringings. And then he's just written some, you know, more traditional narratives. And he's part of this Artist in Residence series that we started last year where we brought in a couple of writers. And just to give them an opportunity beyond having a reading, which so many writers use to let them engage with the community, which means talking to high school students, talking to graduates and undergraduates as well at the University of Iowa, having smaller reading experiences, maybe not necessarily in a bookstore, but in, you know, maybe smaller, more intimate confines where they can talk to, you know, community members who might not usually come to readings. And for them to also experience Iowa and Iowa City, we'll take them out and have a couple of engagements for them where they can just get a better sense of what's going on here.
And included in your literary program, you're having some small press and literary magazine book fairs and a lit crawl and just some pretty cool things. Tell us about those.
Yeah, the lit program unfolds over the week, and there are the traditional readings that happen at places like Prairie Lights and other venues around Iowa City. But we also have a couple of interesting things that are maybe a little bit funkier. We have the lit crawl, which happens on the Friday of the festival, which inhabits 8 different venues in downtown Iowa City. And over the course of 3 hours, there's just a parade of readings. And you can just go from venue to venue. Each reading has a theme, is presented by a lit journal or is presented by, you know, a publishing house. And usually 2 publishing houses or 2 lit journals will kind of combine to create a really weird poetry reading or to make a really interesting narrative reading amongst essayists and fiction writers. And so it's just kind of just 3-hour parade to be able to intake so many different literary voices from around the country and from around the state. And we mean it to be like this entry point for folks who maybe don't see all these readings that come through town or come through our state all year. But like, if you can set aside this one evening, you can see a lot of really great work and hopefully leave with a bunch of, you know, list of writers that you want to follow up on. We also do have the book fair, which happens every year. It's on the Saturday. It takes place at the Mill in downtown Iowa City, where we have about 30 different presses and literary journals that come in, and they have their new books, they have their old catalogs. And it's a great way for both casual and really, you know, intense literary fans to connect with editors, to connect with the publishers whose work they read, or to be introduced to new publishers, to new books, to new writers. And it's a really fun time, and we like doing it at the Mill because it's laid back. Like, you can have a chicken sandwich while you're finding, you know, your new favorite poet.
Well, tell us about the Mission Creek film scene.
This year, one of the expansion points we're doing is bringing film into the mediums that we focus on in the festival. Some people may know that in 2013, an independent art house movie theater was built in downtown Iowa City on the Pedestrian Mall. It's called Film Scene. It's a single screen theater, I think about 70 seats. They've been doing great work, bringing awesome films in. They're doing community films. They're doing community programs. And so they've just been getting super involved in the cultural scene that is Iowa City. And so we wanted to partner with them, and we're co-curating a film program. I can't say anything quite yet, but they've got some really cool premieres that are going to come through, as well as one that I can't talk about. There's a theater and film group called Working Group Theater based in Iowa City that finished a feature film this past fall, and they've been shopping it around to festivals, and we're going to have one of the premieres, the Midwestern premiere of that film, during the Mission Creek Festival.
That's really exciting to have that happening.
Yeah, it's very exciting because it involves artists who are based in Iowa, who have stayed in Iowa. They connected with some friends that they had out in Brooklyn, and they made this film that's called Hopeless Savages, written by Sean Lewis, who is the director of Working Group Theater, and starring him as well. And it's just, it's awesome to be supporting these artists who are here and have decided to keep their craft here and really, you know, support and promote Iowa through the work that they're doing.
Andre continues describing other Mission Creek Festival offerings.
Our food program's been going on for, this will be the 3rd year, and it basically is a celebration of the chefs, and there's so many, we can't include all of them, but just, you know, the chefs and the restaurateurs who are in our area. And so we try to have a special meal almost every night or every day of the festival where, you know, these chefs at places like the Leaf Kitchen or Devotee or the Motley Cow Cafe, Augusta out in Oxford, will set aside time to create a special meal for the festival. We brainstorm these meals and kind of the concepts of them for, you know, 9 or 10 months. And then they've got, you know, 2 hours to make it a really fun event for people. It's just celebrating, you know, the food that's made here and the creativity that goes into food in Iowa City and the surrounding area.
And you sort of touched on this tech and innovation conference that's going to be running in conjunction.
That's probably the biggest expansion point we've had this year, is that in order to honor kind of the burgeoning tech scene that's, you know, occurring in Iowa, we wanted to have a regional conference. You know, a short conference is just going to be on April 4th and 5th, with most of the lectures happening on the 5th, bringing together technologists who are based here, as well as bringing in speakers from the coast to talk about issues in technology and where technology can go. And most important for us is showing that bridge of creativity between the arts world and technology. And the keynote speakers, we met Israel from the Art Genome Project out in New York, where they're working on finding ways of making art accessible basically to the entire world. And kind of breaking down that wall of art that people think, you know, you have to have a degree to know about art, or you have to take these art history classes. Anyone can really, you know, just celebrate art. And so they're using technology to make art more available to people across the world. We thought that'd be a great lecture to kind of, you know, what's the technology behind that project, as well as, you know, how do we make such an important form available to people around the world.
So how do folks get more information and get tickets?
The best way to reach us is missionfreak.com is our website. There is information about, you know, all the programs that are occurring during the week. There's contact info on there if you need to email one of us and find out something more. We do most of our ticketing through MidwestTix.com, based out of Des Moines.
Andre Perry, the Englert Theater's executive director and Mission Creek Festival's co-founder and director, outlining this year's Mission Creek Festival running from April 1st through the 6th in downtown Iowa City. To find out more information about cultural events in Iowa, Iowa Public Radio has an events link on our website at iowapublicradio.org. And while you're there, you can also make your spring tax-deductible pledge of support. Today's Iowa Art Showcase broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Program thanks for this show goes to Kate Greeter, Jason Allreed, Lynette Pullman, Robert Larson, James Rohde, John Pemble, Max Wellman, and Andre Perry. Program assistance was also received from J.N. Selzer, Michael Eagle, and IPR's Mark Simmet. Production thanks goes to Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner. Thanks for this show also goes to IPR's Phil Moss and music director Al Scherz, along with IPR's Eric Jordan, Jason Burns, Garrett Van Leeuwen, and Cooper Holmeyer. Program research was provided by Tressa Glass, Nick Carlo, and Scott Bosco. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. Thanks for joining us. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org.